Big Finish presents Doctor Who, Short Trips, Deleted Scenes by Angus Duncan, read by Fraser Hines. Twelve people had come, in a room meant for about 150. Jemima stole by pretending to sort her lecture notes. These media conferences were always a lottery. She took a sip of water and began. My great-great-grandmother, Céline Tissier, left Paris in the summer of 1908. Though her catalogue of films is considerable, even compared to her friend and mentor, Alice Guy Blanchet, many dismiss her as a stylish dabbler. While the basis of this reputation is debatable, few would argue that it is due, in part, to the notorious premiere of her film, Serpent dans le Jardin. Some eyes rolled, expected. Jemima had worn her special eye-roll-proof cardigan today. The intrigue of lost films made for romantic undergrad conversation, but rarely serious academia. Jemima squared her shoulders within her battle cardigan. The film and its ill-fated premiere have passed into the realms of myth. Stories of audience members fleeing in terror echo those of the Lumiere brothers and that oh-so-convincing train of theirs. A warm chuckle bubbled up near the back. Jemima's chest loosened slightly. Yet if we examine the records and accounts, something more than legend casts a shadow on the cloth of history. The slide projector winked the room into darkness for a wing's beat, and Jemima continued. America? Oh, Alice, why? How can you leave me like this? Said Céline. Alice Guy Blanchet stirred her coffee and smiled at her younger friend. The two women sat in the late spring light, and around them Paris went about its gorgeous business. Blame the studio, said Alice, but Herbert and I have many grand schemes. But what of the baby? It'll be an American. Alice's hand went to the bump in her dress. Well, my mother came here from Chile so I could be born French. Life is full of these little conceits, Céline. You ran to London last year just to break off an engagement. What will I do without you, though? Lamented Céline. What about... Serpent dans le Jardin, said Alice. She took Céline's hand. You have the editing room at Gaumont. I've seen to it. Believe me, we will not be long without a new offering from Céline Tessier. She spoke the name as if it were in lights. Besides, I could not leave Paris to the mercies of Georges, could I? Someone must be here to save us all from all these trousers. And the two women burst into a bouquet of laughter. Jamie McCrimmon gripped the TARDIS control console in a way he'd become begrudgingly familiar with, and the Doctor caught his thunderous expression. Now, look, Jamie, this is no time for recriminations. So this is what? Just bad weather, then, is it? Asked Jamie. Well, actually, yes, you could think of it like that. He didn't finish his sentence. A section of the console erupted in a blossom of smoke. No, this isn't terribly good news, Jamie. The space-time machine rocked violently. Well, let's see, said the Doctor, and threw a rarely touched switch. Ladies and gentlemen, roared the man with the buffalo horn moustache, welcome to Théâtre Robert Houdin, the premier house of illusion in all of Paris. The audience applauded, and Georges Méliès smiled deeply. Tonight, he continued, we are shaded from the glare of reason, and we see only by the light of magic. Offstage, Eugene, George's accomplice, pulled a large lever, and two plumes of green flame erupted to the crowd's delight. The fire shone in the greener eyes of Céline, nestled near the back as usual. She gave a wry smile at the powdered copper sulphate flames. She knew all of Georges's tricks. His illusions were, to Celine, a puzzle to be dismantled in the workshop of her mind. This was her gift. Then a light shone on the aisle. "Christophe," Melier intoned, "bring forth the box." The rocking had stopped, and Jamie got to his feet.
"Why do you not do that in the first place?" said Jamie.
You see, that's the temporal feedback override. When the TARDIS is behaving like that, it means there's someone or something that she's nervous of. Or ripples in the timeline. The doctor's face darkened.
"Oh, I see," said Jamie.
He did not see, but he'd learnt when and when not to press the doctor. Presently, the column came to a rest within the console. "Ah, we've landed, Jamie. The door, if you would."
Celine sat enchanted. How had he done it? Had she underestimated Georges? The room was on its feet, applauding, as everyone welcomed the beautiful blue box that had appeared on stage. Melier stood motionless as a startled spider, looked at Eugene in the wings, and the aging theatre master gave the mother of all shrugs.
However, as the applause began, Georges's instincts took over. He bowed deeply as the doors creaked open.
Lovely to see you all,"
the doctor hallooed in practiced bonhomie and walked out onto the stage. Behind him came Jamie, slinging his sheepskin over his shoulders. Some yards away, in the darkness beyond their sight, Celine's eyes shone again. She knew in that instant that this was not Georges's doing. He wouldn't allow others to steal his precious limelight. Something else was at play here. She felt it.
"My God, invading my stage with your conjurations! How dare you, sirs!"
The two travellers had been ushered to the stage door, whereupon Melier had exploded.
"Monsieur Melier, if we might be permitted to explain..."
The doctor began as the door swung open to reveal Christophe, a young man with hard eyes.
"Would you like me to dispose of them, monsieur?"
"I'll not be disposed of, thank you," said Jamie, rolling up his sleeves.
"Christophe,"
came a distant voice, breaking the standoff. "I hope you aren't being rude to my guests." Celine marched towards the group.
"Celine," said Christophe, suddenly seeming smaller. "You know these men?"
Jamie and the doctor exchanged bewildered looks.
"Indeed," she lied, stopping in front of them.
"I hope you enjoyed my little joke, Georges. I so rarely get to surprise you."
Melier ran a hand over his hairless head.
"So the blue box?"
"A commission," interjected Celine, "for my film."
Melier softened at this. Celine often talked about this fantastical opus of hers.
"Ah," said Melier, "Serpent dans le jardin. How goes it?"
"We are days away," she lied again,
smiling like sliced cake.
"So tell me, how did the box get onto my stage?"
"Why, it was there all along."
"That is impossible."
"Impossible, Georges? You disappoint me."
"And what's to be done with it?"
said Melier, bristling slightly. Seeing his cue, the doctor rounded on him with punishing friendliness.
"That's the fun, you see, monsieur. It's a puzzle. We came out, but how one gets back in is another matter."
Celine flushed slightly, delighted at this quick-witted ally, and Melier could not resist.
"Ha-ha! Then I accept your challenge. I, Melier, shall open this foreign box of mysteries. Christophe, get it into the wings. I must prepare."
And he strode back into the theatre. Christophe hesitated a moment.
"Celine..."
But he stopped short, glanced at Jamie, and then was gone. The doctor jumped down and towards Celine.
"I must say, that was exceptionally kind of you, mademoiselle."
"Tessier. Celine Tessier. Don't mind, dear Georges."
"I shan't. Well, introductions. I am the doctor, and this is my friend, Jamie. Jimmy McCrummon," said the young man. "Thank you for having a wee word with that fella for us."
Celine smiled.
"The pleasure was all mine, Monsieur McCrummon, and may I compliment you on your French?"
Jamie blushed.
"Well, you've got me there. I don't speak any."
Celine narrowed her eyes and then overflowed with laughter.
Oh, really? I don't.
Not a word, he insisted. She laughed again and pushed him ever so slightly.
What an unusual sense of humour you have, monsieur.
The doctor looked on, also amused.
The doctor, Jamie and Celine strolled through the warm Paris night. Celine took the doctor's arm, but it was Jamie who had her full attention. He asked endless questions that she delighted in answering, especially about her films. For all Jamie had seen in his travels, the magic of the moving image endured.
So, said Celine, as they settled outside a cafe,
where are you from, really?
We're travellers, mademoiselle, said the doctor. We are from our last destination.
Celine eyed him intently.
Oh, come, doctor. I've lied enough for the both of us tonight, no? You and Jamie appeared from the ether itself.
Surely, mademoiselle, that is impossible, said the doctor, his face like a kindly mountain.
Which is unfortunate, doctor, because it is also what happened, said Celine.
There was a long computational silence as all three of them decided what the next move would be.
Where are you lodging? Said Celine, finally.
No one spoke, so she continued.
I see. Then you will stay with me. I have decided.
The doctor was taken aback.
Are you sure that would be, that is to say, entirely?
Really?
Jamie asked excitedly.
We could stay with you.
Of course, said Celine, beaming at Jamie. My aunt's flat on Rochechouart is big enough for an entire circus troupe and the elephants. You must, I insist.
Can we, doctor?
The old man considered. One couldn't very well see Paris in a day, he thought, but then to him a day could be several orders of forever or just a single blade of grass in the endless fields of time, if he so chose.
Well, doctor?
Jemima looked out at her audience. Was it her imagination, or did she have them? That summer marked a period of intense creativity for Celine. Varying accounts talk of her flat on Rochechouart becoming an intense crush of actors, carpenters and matte painters. A mess of colour, sawdust and plaster. In this time, three short films were produced. Delaying Serpent dans le Jardin, first the comedy Le Chien à Clarissa, then the sombre Une conversation avec la mort, and finally Le Duel.
As she spoke, slides flashed behind her. Lastly came an image of two young men, rapiers locked together in mortal combat. This gentleman on the right featured in all three during that febrile summer of 1908.
Memoirs speak of a handsome foreign gentleman who was the fast companion of Tessier, going with her nearly everywhere.
Again a chuckle came from near the back.
Jemima continued, this new muse of hers, the future star of Serpent dans le Jardin, marks a departure from her collaboration with the actor Christophe Castile, to whom she had been engaged before her sojourn to London in 1906.
Jamie sat in the warehouse courtyard, his shadow long in the evening sun. The afternoon's filming had gone very well. He had never considered himself to be the sort of person who could act. Back home, he'd stand in the tavern with his kinsmen and hear tales told by those who had the knack for such things. Men with rich voices and a wildness about them. Something Jamie saw, even now, in the eyes of these new folk.
Jamie, called Celine, as she squeezed through the courtyard entrance. Her hat caught on a loose nail on the door and her untamable red hair escaped. She pirouetted, seized her hat from the nail, and made a show of scolding the door. She would often clown for Jamie like this.
What do you think? Said Jamie, looking up.
Oh, Jamie, it's magnificent.
Towering above them, rendered in wood and plaster, was a beautiful woodland green dragon, its skin freshly painted by Jamie, just drying in the fading light. This huge automaton was the real star of Serpent dans le Jardin. Though Celine had designed it herself, its construction had set her back over a year.
Did you ever see anything like it? She said.
Oh, well, not exactly, but I've been around, you know. Seen all manner of things.
Oh, yes, of course. You and the doctor travel, don't you? All over. In that box of yours?
Aye, that's...
Eh? Said Jamie. Celine turned. Come now, Monsieur McCrimmon. I've had weeks to consider. George still can't open it, and I know what I saw. She took a step forward. You're not like the rest of us. That box, it's a machine, isn't it? Not just any machine either, but something... something I've never seen before. Jamie's heart was beating, as though we were face to face with a tiger. Celine took another step closer.
Do you know why George started making illusions on film?
He was shooting in the street once, when his camera jammed, and the film inside began to expose irregularly. When he watched it back, he saw wonderful things. He saw men disappear and be replaced by other men, women becoming children, dogs becoming carriages. He saw suddenly like God, flicking through the pages of the world. She fixed her eyes on his. Sometimes, Jamie, I have this inescapable feeling that you're not really here, that you're an impression of something that's already been.
Celine now stood so close to Jamie that he barely even noticed her fingers weave between his own.
That's what it does, isn't it? Your machine. It sounds preposterous, but I know what I saw.
What?
Said Jamie, his throat dry as parchment.
An edit. A cut in the story of time.
So are you saying that I'm on the wrong page, so to speak?
Oh, I wouldn't say that.
And there, on a warm evening in Paris, a short 183 years since the day he was born, a piper's son was kissed in the shadow of a dragon.
Christophe stood at the half-open door. He had loved her since the moment he saw her, and for a time she had loved him. But now there she was, in the arms of some boy. He couldn't allow it.
You know, it's not prudent to spy on people. Christophe whirled around. The doctor stood behind him, regarding the floor. But then, people in pain can't be expected to act prudently.
The doctor lifted his head, smiling gently.
Pain, monsieur? You mistake me.
Ah, do I? Good, because I'd rather thought you'd lost something.
What would you know about loss, monsieur? Said Christophe coldly.
The doctor pulled the courtyard door closed and fixed his ice-blue eyes upon Christophe. Possessing things come so terribly easily to some men that losing them can feel cruel, intolerably cruel. In my experience, only the very best of men cannot be tempted to answer that cruelty with more. Christophe had had enough of this and made to walk away, but the doctor caught his arm with a grip that surprised the young man.
I do sincerely hope that you are the best of men, the doctor whispered before releasing him.
Christophe paused a moment to regard this strange little man, and something like fear crept into his heart. The doctor watched him as he left, but knew he couldn't watch him always. Pity.
On August the 4th, 1908, a fire ravaged the studio warehouse, said Jemima, her nose prickling with sadness. Numerous props and creatures that were to appear in Serpent dans le Jardin were utterly destroyed. While officially an accident, Celine herself believed otherwise. In one of her many letters to Alice Guy, she wrote, "He couldn't let me be happy, Alice. None of them can." Notably after that, Christophe Castile was never again seen in Paris.
Jamie and the doctor walked silently by the river. They had fallen into the habit of these mournful strolls.
You know, Jamie, if there's one thing I can't stand, it's waste, said the doctor, unwrapping a peppermint he'd found in his pocket. There are so many wretched things in this universe, and... Oh, it won't do at all.
She's devastated, doctor.
I don't suppose that she could build another.
Jamie shook his head. She'd not let on, but she's nearly flat broke, doctor.
She'd invested nearly everything.
The doctor crunched his peppermint and laughed dryly.
It's funny, isn't it? We see more than our fair share of monstrous things, but when we actually need one...
The doctor trailed off, but it was too late.
Hey, that's a point.
No, Jamie, come on.
Let's go fetch her a dragon, doctor, eh?
Get that camera contraption of hers. Find a place with real beasties and... No,
shouted the doctor.
Why not? Cried Jamie, stepping in the doctor's way. There's no guarantee that I could get us back. Why, then so what? She comes with us.
That's not your decision to make, Jamie.
She knows about the TARDIS. You told her?
Oh, she's known all along.
The doctor took this in for a second.
Oh, no. Jamie, I'm sorry. I know you two have become very attached to each other. I allowed it to happen because...
Oh, you allowed it to happen, did you?
Said Jamie, becoming angry.
Because of Victoria,
continued the doctor. Jamie stood very still.
What about Victoria? Said Jamie.
The doctor sighed. Look, I know how fond you were of her.
I was too, of course, but with you it was, well, it was different, wasn't it?
Jamie kicked a stone into the river, then turned to the doctor.
Ah, well, maybe that's true and maybe that's not, he said, a slight catch in his voice.
But I'll tell you this, Celine needs our help.
Is that not what we do, Doctor? I mean, what's the point of having a lummoxing great time and space machine if you can't use it to help folk?
The doctor said nothing but stared at the ripples in the water.
Celine awoke from a brittle sleep. It was some time in the early hours, but she was by now quite used to languishing in these stretches of untime. She had come to know the stillness of her home as if she were at the centre of some vast web of silence. Something was moving beyond her door. She felt it. A sudden anger at this intrusion to her misery took her. In moments, she was at the door and opened it as if drawing a blade.
Celine,
said Jamie, his hand still raised to knock. For a moment, they regarded each other. He had not seen her for days. Her long red hair was down about her shoulders and her eyes were spent with weeping. She put a hand to her mouth.
Oh, Jamie, please, I just want...
But he reached out and took her hand. At his feet lay the large case of her camera.
Celine, I'd like to show you something.
As they felt their way through the backstage darkness of the theatre, the doctor popped up in front of them like a rumpled genie. Celine, though, pleased to see him, was wary.
Only Georges and Eugene have the key.
How did you unlock the doors?
One has one's ways, said the doctor.
What am I doing here, doctor? Jamie has told me that you thought of a way to replace what was lost, but how?
Well, my dear, as anyone in show business will tell you, sometimes the understudy shines brighter than the star.
And he stepped aside, motioning her towards the TARDIS doors. Though no other living soul stood in the wings of the theatre that night, all theatres have their ghosts. Any attending spirits would have heard a wheezing, groaning noise like tearing metal, and high above it, a young woman's voice.
I knew it! I knew it!
And so, said Jemima, according to the journals of the Gaumont Studios technicians, Tessier flew into the cutting room like a demon. Despite the fire, she had mysteriously completed Serpent dans le Jardin and was feverishly determined to have the film ready for its planned August the 20th premiere. She forbade anyone else from seeing it, refusing to even make a copy. In a further letter to Alice Guy, she wrote, I tell you, Alice, you will be so proud of me. They will see that we cannot be stopped.
Jamie walked into his TARDIS bedroom where the doctor lay sleeping. The journey had taken a strange toll on him. They'd arrived safely back in Paris, but no sooner had they landed and parted ways with an excited Celine than the doctor had collapsed. His skin had become deathly cold, and he barely seemed to breathe. Jamie began to feel afraid. Afraid and guilty. In taking Celine to that primeval world of beasts and colossal insects, had they indeed done something terribly wrong? The doctor had been dispersed into the depths and now drifted in all directions. The great mind had invited him into the impossible ocean where it swam. There, do you see? An entanglement. It threatens the narrative. What if it were to be left? What would be the real harm? The wound would heal and most likely be forgotten. He nearly allowed himself to disconnect and float back towards the surface, but but the other one here gently guided him. If we can see, the others can see. A path could be traced. A path that began with us. He had allowed himself to forget about the danger of unwanted attention. Difficult. Both minds agreed. That will not do. The doctor's eyes opened and he gasped greedily for air, giving poor Jamie quite a start.
"Doctor, you're back," said Jamie, rushing to embrace him.
"No, no, Jamie, listen to me. This is important. How long have I been asleep?"
"Huh? Is that all that was? That's you sleeping, is it? How long?"
"Well, it's got to be at least a week." The doctor put his hands to his head, massaging his temples.
"What's wrong, doctor?"
"Jamie, we've got to get that film back." The theatre lobby billowed with a wash of colour and voices. Among the perfumed crowd stood the doctor and Jamie, resplendent in borrowed evening wear. "Now remember, Jamie, as soon as the film is over, you distract Celine and I'll make for the projector," said the doctor, smiling at all comers. Jamie grimaced. Subterfuge had never been a strong suit of his.
"This is not a great idea.
This whole escapade has been a pretty bad idea, Jamie. Why stop now?"
"Then why did you agree to do it in the first place?" said Jamie, loosening his bow tie.
"Because, Jamie, you asked me to," shouted the doctor.
Some heads turned to look at him as he regained his composure, but the answer hung in the air between them for a time. Then the doctor put his arm round Jamie's shoulders.
"Besides, the TARDIS pointed out to me and added a complication that I, well, frankly, I'd failed to consider before. You see, Jamie, time is..."
"There she is,"
whispered Jamie. Celine had descended the stairwell and now greeted actors and friends. Jamie was forlorn. Her moment of glory had come, and yet he was condemned to masquerade as her ally. The cruelty of it pierced his chest like a glass arrow. "Jamie, are you going to be all right?"
He closed his eyes. "Aye, doctor."
In the auditorium, the lights lowered and Celine took to the stage. Once there, she bowed her head for a moment, then spoke. "My friends, each night we dream and in the morning they're as Monsieur Bentley's snowflakes, no? Perfect, unique, and gone forever. I have caught one such dream for you tonight. All I can say is..." Her eyes found Jamie in the crowd. "Thank you." The glass arrow in Jamie's chest worked its way deeper. Then it began. The titles were displayed, and then there they were, Jamie and company, dressed as intrepid explorers of another world. The crowd cheered as quicksand was fought and snakes were wrestled with. Jamie's face, caked in makeup, silently shouted brave words, which then shone, white on black, in beautiful serifed letters. In the wings stood Celine, listening to the coos and the delighted laughter of the audience, and she too watched Jamie's fine face as it commanded the frame. She had never been so happy. Then the screaming started, spreading through the crowd like the howling of dogs. Some clambered over the aisles while others simply hid their eyes. On the screen, there strode a dragon, but no beast of wood and plaster. These were real winged titans of tooth and claw, captured by the director herself on a lush and savage world, thousands of light years from home. Celine took to the stage and the great serpent moved across the embroidery of her dress.
"My friends, please be calm."
But it was too late. The hysteria had turned to a kind of anger, a rage of incomprehension. Jamie turned to the doctor, but he was gone. Then, all at once, the beautiful images from that world, warmed by a deep orange sun, fell away from the layered silks of Celine's dress, onto the floor and into nothing. The projector had been toppled, and then there was blackness. In the dark, the screaming intensified. It was nearly a full minute before the doors were opened and light could flood the room. Then the auditorium lights themselves flared and Eugene swept the auditorium, helping fallen patrons to their feet. On stage stood Celine, almost unable to move. Jamie had jumped up beside her now and she held on to him as though she might drown.
"Why, Jamie, why are they so afraid? It was beautiful, was it not?"
"Aye, Celine, it was,"
said Jamie, grateful for her chance to speak truly.
"Celine!"
George stalked down the aisle, a concerned look on his face. He had been delayed,
and had just arrived in time to break up the riot in his lobby. "What happened here?" Her reply came in tiny, wounded gasps.
"The people, they did not like the... Then the projector..." She turned to Jamie. "What happened to the projector?"
He looked into her eyes. Eyes that trusted him completely and hated himself for what came next.
"I don't know,"
he lied. And the glass arrow splintered. At the back, Eugene found the projector. Both reels had been wrenched from their housings. Eugene stood, looked towards the stage and, without realising, removed his hat as he spoke.
"Celine, the film, it is gone."
She said nothing, but Jamie felt her hand slide away from his, lifeless as a falling curtain. The column of the console rose and fell as always. Jamie still stared at the monitor. Paris had faded from the screen, and now they were once again tumbling through space and time.
"I think we might have a short while before we land again, Jamie," said the doctor, making his usual adjustments. "I'd like to put some distance between Paris and us. Why not get some rest?"
Jamie nodded and walked towards his bedroom. The doctor looked after him for a moment, and then glanced at the cupboard in which he had placed the film. He made a mental note to repair the torn frames at some point, before adjusting the relative continuum stabiliser, scattering some breadcrumbs through the vortex to confuse anyone who might be tempted to follow them. Jamie sat on his bed and took a note from his pocket. The doctor had wanted to make a swift exit from Paris, as was his habit, but Jamie couldn't countenance leaving without saying goodbye. When he had called upon Celine only days later, he had found the flat soberly ransacked and, upon the mantel, the note that he now held. "To my dearest Jamie, I am very sorry to be so cowardly, but I think that to see you would be unbearable. I confess that it is not easy for me to see the sheer breadth of the heavens themselves and yet be brought so low. I have decided to try and do better elsewhere. I will never forget your kindness to me these last months and for trusting me with the secrets of your astonishing machine. It is my deepest hope that I will see your face again one day, but I know in my heart that you have much yet to do. You and that doctor of yours. Look after him, Jamie. He loves you dearly, as do I. Yours always, Celine." Less than a week after the premiere of Serpent dans le Jardin, Céline Tessier left for New York. She would work for Alice Guy and Herbert Blanchet's company, Solax, at its studios in New Jersey, as a production head and editor until the studio's bankruptcy in 1921. In 22, she took up a position as a teacher of photography and married the father of her only daughter, Rosa, in 1923. She would never again direct a film and died in Long Island in 1968, 3 days before her 86th birthday. Until the end, she asserted that Serpent dans le Jardin was not lost, but simply missing. Thank you. Jemima looked up from her paper and a small applause came. She stood by the door to thank those who attended as they left. However, as she walked back into the lecture hall to collect her things, she noticed that she was not yet alone. Standing in the aisle of the auditorium was a very tall and unusually dressed man. In fact, he had something of the Parisian about him, certainly the Bohemian. He smiled hugely and spoke.
"I very much enjoyed your lecture," he said, his voice like a brass band.
"Oh," said Jemima, "thank you." There was a bizarre silence to which the stranger seemed impervious. "Are you a student or a lecturer or..."
"Oh, sort of both, really."
Again the smile came. However, before Jemima could excuse herself, he had taken a step forward and produced a key.
"I was hoping to catch you because, you see, I've got screening room 4 booked for an hour. I was wondering if I could tempt you."
"I'm really sorry, I've got to get going," lied Jemima. The stranger's face changed, with clownish speed, to an expression of incomparable melancholy.
"Oh, what a pity. I felt sure you'd be interested in seeing an original Tessier.
The hairs on the back of Jemima's neck sprung on end. You have a Tessier? Said Jemima. The stranger reverted to his Cheshire cat grin.
Oh, yes, a real Bobby Dazzler.
Jemima did not know quite what to say. She had followed the absurd-looking man in the hat and long scarf down the corridor to screening room 4. She had taken her seat as he requested. The lights had dimmed, and something that had not been seen in 110 years danced amazingly in front of her unbelieving eyes. Somehow, this man, this scarecrow made of teeth and scarf, possessed a copy of Serpent dans le Jardin. When the lights came up, she simply said, "May we see it again?"
"Certainly," he beamed, and motioned with his finger towards the projection booth to roll the film again.
As it played a second time, she gathered together enough of her senses to ask, "How?"
"Well, you see," said the stranger, opening a small bag of popcorn, "I acquired it through a family friend, shall we say?"
And the stranger nodded toward the screen, which bore the face of the film's hero.
"He had it all along? The thieving little..."
she whispered. At this, though, the stranger was roused.
"Oh, no! You've got it all wrong!"
"Have I?" said Jemima, folding her arms.
"Oh, yes," he said,
a touch of that melancholy coming into his eyes once again.
"Yes, because, you see, he really was the very best of men."
And for a time they sat in silence. Finally, Jemima said, "Why haven't you come forward before?" The stranger chewed his popcorn.
"Well, if I'm completely honest, I failed to appreciate quite how important it was until recently. But then I told a friend of mine all about it, and she got rather cross with me."
He smiled again.
"This was her idea."
And he bellowed to the back of the theatre.
"Say hello, Sarah."
A distant cooey came from the projection booth. Jemima nodded slowly, and then her green eyes began to sparkle with tears. The stranger offered her the end of his scarf.
"Oh, this is so silly,"
she said, dabbing her eyes with it.
"I've dreamed of seeing this my whole life, but now I just wish that my great-great-grandmother could have seen this. You know, one more time?"
"Oh, I shouldn't worry," the stranger rumbled. "No, it's early yet."
And somewhere, 50 years ago, but just a bit later that same afternoon, the lights were dimmed in a comfortable living room in Long Island. A stranger opened a fresh bag of popcorn and handed it to an old woman who had always loved the movies.